And you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And all I'm going to say to you is, fuck off and die.
She'll make a lovely doll after I finish with you. I told you your webs were useless.
Spider-Man!
It's too hot. It's too hot. Something must have hit the control lever. Turn it off.
Want to save energy and keep yourself comfortable? Turn down your thermostat 1 degree Celsius or consider installing a programmable thermostat. If every household in BC with electric space heating turned down their heat by 1 degree for 8 hours a day, it would save enough electricity to power science world for over 75 years. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
Hey, this is Textbook, CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Coast Salish people. My name is Josh. Today, it is the writers episode. We have three different segments from writers, talking about writing, talking about the craft, talking about what it's all about. It's a gloomy winter day here, 4 o'clock. The show is Textbook. The first segment today is with the UBC, which is the school newspaper. Talked with a couple of editors there about what they do. And yeah, I hope you enjoy it. Thanks so much. Hello, you're listening to Textbook CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Josh. I'm here in the studio today with two editors from the UBC, Samantha McCabe and Jack Howen, who are coming to talk to us about the school newspaper and some of the current affairs going on this week. If you guys don't know, the UBC is the university's official news source, printed weekly. It's a really good little thing to pick up if you're on campus. Do you guys want to introduce yourselves?
Hi, my name is Sam. I'm the news editor over at the UBC.
I'm Jack, and I'm the coordinating editor.
Great. So what's been on your radar this week? I know there's AUS things are big. Do you want to give maybe a quick overview of this story for people that aren't familiar with it?
Yeah, so basically what happened was the AUS, we got a hold of their budget, and we found some kind of concerning things, namely that their budget for the retreat was like a large proportion of their overall budget, which in case people don't know is to serve services for the entire arts undergraduate body. So basically we published a story just kind of analyzing their budget and pointing out some of the stuff that gets paid for. Another component of that story is that recently they overspent $35,000, I believe, on Startup, which is their orientation event at the start of the year. And to compensate for that, cut the student life portfolio, but didn't cut their retreat.
And what's the student life portfolio? What would that mean for students now that that's cut? Or what would that mean for art students?
Basically, cuts were made to a lot of categories, but the three main ones I would say are sports, Arts Week, and academic development, which includes tutoring. The AUS also puts on like a lot of events for students, so those would be cut as well.
What's the backlash been like?
It's been really interesting to watch because like normally we don't get a huge amount of engagement on issues in our comments section, so it's always fun when there's people on both sides talking about it. So the AUS issued their response really quickly on their Facebook page and had a lot of support from AUS people and their friends and the like. the UBC subreddit has probably been the most outspoken group who have been chastising, to put it lightly, the AUS. And there have been, you know, numerous posts about the, quote, gross mismanagement and overspending and all this stuff.
And just as a follow-up, we are going to be looking into the budgets of basically every student society now that we've kind of looked into this and, like, decided that it's something that deserves our attention kind of thing. Because I think it really is important because even more so than the AMS, like, even though art students are only giving, I think, $13 to the AUS, it does amount out to a lot of money, and it is money that you're supposed to directly be kind of getting back in services, whereas the AMS funds, like, a lot of external things, a lot of huge projects. So I thought it was really frustrating for students that money was cut from student life and wasn't cut from the council retreat, the executive retreat, networking events, and advertising. Like, that says a lot.
The advertising one definitely is.
Yeah. So that does say a lot. So I think that Reddit's good because it takes... They really do seem to care about issues like that, especially divisive issues like that, and go into it, which is cool.
I think it speaks to kind of a bigger question about the function that the paper serves, and, like, yeah, holding these organizations accountable and holding the AMS accountable, and I think that you guys do a really good job with that. So Reddit's a really big place where people do have these intense conversations about the management of the university and maybe how the university is going. I know UBC Insiders used to have a show on CITR. Where are some of the other sources that you guys are looking for, or news or commentary on UBC stuff?
Sometimes we do look to larger newspapers for stories. The thing about the UBC is that it's like a hyper-local paper, so we are delving more deeply into issues that mainstream Vancouver won't care about, frankly. The Vancouver Sun has a pretty good UBC beat right now. Mm-hmm. They have a couple of reporters, like, exclusively on UBC. That stuff is usually more catered to bigger issues like sexual assault, safety on campus, Galloway, stuff like that. But yeah, they are valuable sources.
We rely a lot on our network of sources that we've kind of built up over the years. Mm-hmm. Of people, you know, in the AMS and the university who aren't, like, necessarily whistleblowers, but who will talk to us about things.
Who are just open about what they know.
Exactly. And occasionally, like, we do get the odd anonymous tip every once in a while. But it's just talking to people and looking through press releases and going to every council meeting and just kind of putting in those endless hours behind the scenes.
Yeah, meetings at UBC are disgusting, but I genuinely think that it's super valuable to go to the Board of Governors and Council and Senate. Yeah, because those are where decisions that affect UBC students are made.
Right, trudging through that bureaucracy a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You guys have both been at the paper for a few years. Do you want to tell me about how you got started?
I've probably been there the longest of anyone currently involved. I started in my first year, and I've been there for 4 years now. So I started my first year writing for the men's hockey team. I signed up at Imagine Day. I was a lit kid in high school, and I knew I wanted to write for the UBC. I was one of those nerds who read the UBC in grade 12, like, before I got accepted. So I signed up on Imagine Day for every section and kind of hovered over sports because I was like, I only kind of like hockey, and that's about it. But I eventually checked it, and then the next day I got an email from the sports editor, who said, we're looking for someone to cover the men's hockey team for the whole year. Like, just take that beat. And I was like, okay, fine. I'm still hyped up from Imagine Day and from all the speeches at Doug Mitchell. And I took it, and I had an absolute blast. And I barely set foot in the office and barely talked to any other editors because I was petrified. And I just talked to my one editor, Natalie. And then towards the end of the year, she basically told me that she would be leaving next year and that I had to take her job. and there would be, and I didn't really have a say in that. So I was sports editor the next year. And then I switched to opinions and blog. So I ran the opinion section and our blog. So kind of the lighthearted stuff and then the really heavy stuff, like the all-abortion protests last year. And then this year I'm coordinating editor, which is kind of like it would be head honcho if we weren't a collective.
He said regretfully.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm much more newbie than that. Basically, I transferred from McGill. I went to McGill my first year, and last year was my first school year at UBC. And I also signed up at Imagine Day, I believe, and started writing for the news section. We had two amazing news editors last year, because news is the only section with two editors, Moira and Emma. They were super great, and I, like, immediately also was just, like, super eager, threw myself into it. And, yeah, I found it really rewarding. And then at the end of the year, myself and my current co-editor, Sruthi, like, had become really close, and we decided to kind of co-run together. You can't technically co-run, but we knew we wanted to do it together. So, yeah, it was kind of – so this is only my second year of involvement at the USC.
Cool. I think another – one of the really big stories this year, and, Jack, you said you just came from the inauguration, the official ceremony. This is Santa Ono. Sam, were you also at the ceremony? No, you weren't.
I have writers there, but no, I did not go.
So, Jack, how was it?
It was about as entertaining as it could have been, I think. It was – I mean, it was definitely geared towards the old academics who were in attendance, you know, extolling the virtues of UBC as a place of excellence and Santa Ono as the knight in shining armor who's going to lead it to greener pastures. So a lot of people spoke, and some of their speeches were really good. Little dry, of course, but what academic leadership ceremony isn't? But yeah, it was fun to take photos of.
And do you think we have indication to believe that this is, you know, he is the knight in shining armor? I think there's a lot of people would agree there's some things to address.
Yeah. So a lot of the rhetoric around Santa Ono, from the university and admittedly at times from the UBC has been that he's this, you know, incredible, wonderful dude who's going to take UBC and elevate it and just increase engagement so drastically. But the fact of the matter is there are serious underlying issues, like transparency in the Board of Governors. We've struggled to cover them this year. I know Sam was just trying to go to the meeting yesterday and found once again that it had started early, without notification to students, and they only posted that the meeting would happen the day before. So there are still definite issues to be worked out, and Santa Ono, I think, is going to help with those. And we've already seen some improvement in, there have been a couple broadcast emails from the Board of Governors that have directly addressed those concerns of transparency and committed to being more open. And I think that's where Santa Ono's strengths really shine, is in communication directly with the student body and with the faculty and engaging them and bringing them into conversations. We'll see what specific policies or changes come out of it. We still haven't seen a ton of those, but it's early yet. But those are definitely Santa Ono's strengths, is building an atmosphere of collaboration. And I know how hacky and lame that sounds, but when you look at how students at the University of Cincinnati reacted when he left, you can really see, like, there is a bit of this, I don't want to call it a cult of personality, but maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's the bow ties, maybe it's something else, but people really love him. So we'll see what hard policies come out of it, but there is something, I think, to be said for having this leader who is, you know, boots on the ground, talking to people all the time.
Yeah, and at, like, the risk of giving him too much of the benefit of the doubt, it is very hard to come into a system as, like, categorically designed to be non-transparent as UBC is, especially the Board of Governors. And it's very hard for a new president. I can imagine it's very hard for a new president to come in and completely overhaul the system when there are big hats that are sitting at the table that have been used to sitting at the table for years and years. So that's a little difficult, I can see. There is a point where we haven't seen super tangible change from him yet, but I do kind of want to remain positive about it just because he did come in with a really interesting rhetoric about mental health, for example. He has been a champion of mental health. I think, regardless, that's a good start, that he's very open about wanting change for that. And Jack does have a really good point on the communication front. Yeah, it is just very hard for one person to change an entire system that's been historically lacking.
You guys mentioned before that you have a magazine publication coming up that's going to be a special issue, I guess, kind of on diversity. Do you want to talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so something I've wanted to do for a little while is is create like a full length serious magazine. The UBC does our spoof issue every year, where we spoof a publication. Last year it was Sports Illustrated, that kind of thing. But I wanted to put together something that really showcases the long form journalism that I know our staff can do. So we had a big long meeting about it, and we talked about it a lot, and we came up with the theme of diversity, because it's broad enough to include obviously a whole bunch of different viewpoints, but narrow enough that we can actually focus it around a theme and a voice. So yeah, we've got volunteers and staff and editors currently churning, like working away at that, and our visual people are on the case too. So yeah, I'm very excited for that. We've given ourselves a longer deadline in we're planning to release it in mid-February, so we have some time to work on it. I'm really excited about it.
What kind of stories are going to be in there? What kind of angles on diversity are people taking?
Yeah, so one of the stories I'm interested to read is going to be about First Nations languages and the preservation of those. What UBC is doing, what specific people at UBC are doing, what kind of research they're bringing in, why it's important in the first place that we preserve these languages that maybe only a dozen or less or fewer people actually speak. We're going to be talking about accessibility. We've got a photo essay coming in about body positivity. There's a lot of different stuff that I'm really excited to get back and look through.
To like kind of go a little bit more in depth on the theme, we really wanted something that would be like an all-encompassing look at UBC, because like we recognize that UBC is a diverse student population, so we think that diversity is a super important topic. So we are going to be looking at all different types of diversity, so like gender, sex, physical diversity, racial, the whole spectrum basically. So yeah, we really do just want it to be about creating something for UBC students that like showcases our student body.
Last week, you guys had an opinion piece come out about the anti-abortion protests that were going on outside of the Nest. And I thought you guys handled that really well, and you had a really great opinion piece about that. Do you want to talk a little bit about the community's sort of reaction to what's been going on? And this is a yearly thing as well, but it felt maybe more prominent or more visible this year.
Sure, yeah. We were really trying to give a lot of coverage to it because we do recognize that it is an issue that's really at the forefront of students' thoughts when it's a protest that's happening on campus. And we did see a lot of engagement with it from both sides. Basically, the coverage we strived for this year was I wrote an objective piece, just this is happening, this is the student response. Overwhelmingly, the student response has been one in support of the counter-protest or the pro-choice side. It's been quite respectful. The pro-choice side, there was one student or one person that covered one of the pro-life or anti-abortion signs with a blanket. So it's kind of just been like a dialogue opening up on campus almost. So yeah, that's been... It's been really interesting to look at how students engage with that. We have received a flood of opinion letters. So far, we've only published the counter-protest side, but we do have a few coming out on the anti-abortion side. So that will be really interesting. We're trying to present, and from the newspaper's point of view, we're trying to present an objective viewpoint so that students get information, they get the opinions of other students around them, and then they can make their own decisions, kind of thing.
Yeah, so it's been interesting. Like, our role, as we see it, is to present things as objectively as we can, in that these are happening and this has been the response, like Sam said, and then to let students draw their own conclusions from there. And then the opinion side of things comes from those students and those people who have maybe read our coverage.
I can say that... objectively that these have been going on yearly, I believe, since 2001, sometimes more often than yearly, and there has been significant student backlash almost every year since then.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's their goal, too. Like, you talk to any of them, and their goal is to shock people with the graphic images and then draw them into a conversation, which has happened a lot recently. I talked to a psychology prof last year when this happened about whether their style of protesting actually works, and their style of protesting being showing these graphic images. And And the result, or the response from the psychology side of UBC was, no, this doesn't work. It's more likely to entrench people in their own position that they already had and make people defensive and dig their heels in. But what we've seen this year, regardless of whether people are digging their heels in and maybe just going back and forth, is a lot of discussions around the protest and counter-protest site itself. People are actually engaging in discussions. Sometimes it gets heated, but for the most part, it's been really respectful, aside from the obvious one where that one person covered up the sign and then kicked the rest of them down.
And an interesting development this year on the note of their images, like the graphic images, has been that last year they had also images equating abortion with the Holocaust and with genocide, and those they've just since decided to not include those particular images in their protest display this year. In an interview with the president of UBC Lifeline, which is the club that puts on the event, I was told that that choice was made because while they do want to jar students with the abortion images, they found that the Holocaust and genocide images were too distracting.
Sam, before you were talking about kind of some of the challenges of presenting this stuff and, you know, the basic challenges of just objective reporting versus having some opinion pieces and the challenges of covering this sort of material, how would you describe the state of media maybe more largely around Canada these days? I don't know if you guys have aspirations of going into journalism later, but I was wondering if you guys had anything to say about that.
Yeah, I think that we're both pretty into going into journalism at this point, aka accepting a low pay grade. But it is challenging. I think people forget a lot that we're not to be like, oh, my life sucks. But I think people do forget a lot that we are students and we do have our own opinions on these issues. So it can be really, really difficult to report objectively on something that you feel strongly about one way or the other. So, yeah, that part's difficult. Canadian media today is interesting.
To say the least. Yeah. I mean, man, talking about Canadian media always is just like, it just gets meta so fast when you're talking with journalists about it. But, yeah, it's, I mean, what do you say about wanting to enter an industry that is like, that is by some certainly objective measures dying? And by others declining. But I think maybe now more than ever in recent years, it's important that people join the new ranks of journalists. Obviously, Donald Trump isn't happening here, but he's happening next to us. And as Pierre Trudeau said, we're going to feel every shake and grumble of that. So I think in the States, certainly, there are a fresh batch of challenges that await journalists in the next 4 to 8 years, and we're going to certainly feel some of those. So it's, in some ways, from maybe a masochistic point of view, it's exciting to be wading into these depths, hopefully. But, yeah, basically we just want to get a start and then see where it goes.
Absolutely. I think that's a great place to wrap it up. Sam and Jack, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. No problem.
Are you interested in Indigenous issues?
Are you down with decolonization?
Do you have something to say?
Or have a topic to share?
We have just the thing.
Join UBC's first ever Indigenous Radio Collective.
We're a team of Indigenous and non-Indigenous people.
I'm Niska from my mother.
From the Tahltan Territory.
I'm a settler from Washington State.
I'm from the Qualicum and Musqueam First Nations.
I am Quechua Indigenous from Saraguro, Ecuador.
We broadcast from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land
of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Whatever you want to talk about, we're into it.
Everyone is welcome, no experience necessary.
Unceded Airwaves airs every Wednesday from 1 to 2 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
And we meet every Thursday from 4 to 5 p.m. to plan our upcoming shows.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Unceded Airwaves.
We want to hear your story.
This is Sasha Bilal, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
I love Hollywood. As a station, we believe in playing content with artistic and cultural merit, and sometimes that category includes material which can be construed as offensive. For those who have children nearby or are sensitive to provocative material, the following broadcast may have strong language, themes, or be otherwise objectionable. Please consider tuning out and revisiting CITR after this program.
Textbook 101.9 FM, you heard it here first. That was a content advisory. The next segment, it's a reading from Ben Stevenson, and it does have some crude language, but it's a really good interview, and it was great having Ben on the show. So this is a segment I did with him yesterday, some readings. This is our middle segment. This is a little story time segment. Ben is a UBC MFA creative writing student. So yeah, hope you enjoy this one. Today with Ben Stevenson, who is a MFA student and a novelist. He's here to read a couple of poems and a short story. Ben, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm good. I'm feeling good.
Great.
Friend Hugo is waving to me through the glass.
Great.
That was nice.
We have some support outside too. Do you want to go ahead and start with the reading, and then we'll have a little conversation after?
Yeah, sounds good. Okay, I'm going to read two poems and then a short excerpt from the novel I'm trying to write. So here's the first poem. It's called Gull. Can he truly be so opposed to this seagull that he needs to shove the extra chair toward the bird to protect his precious space, I wonder, imagining something else, asking, can you truly be so opposed to this white man in ugly gray t-shirt and white framed glasses that you need to shame him in a contemporary Canadian bird poem? That's the first one. Both somehow of my poems for this ended up being about birds, which was not on purpose at all. There's another poem. It's called Bird Shit. Then Dom wrote a poem embedded with trick images that kept skipping us back to earlier time codes like looping GIFs or linked glitches in its frames. I wrote a poem containing the phrase, your ass in my face, and posted an unshaved video of me writing poems above an obscenely ironic caption. For 2 years, I'd been trying to destroy my public image so that I could disappear, and no one would know why they might care. It was kind of like suicide, but not exactly. Once Dave wrote a poem so beautiful, I cried in front of everyone. But then I wrote a poem about you guessed it. This was bad news. A poem could be about anything other than a poem about a poem, we'd all agreed. Truth is, I couldn't tell what kind of bird it was. In retrospect, this was the point in the poem when I briefly lost the poem. That was the point when Anne wrote a poem about losing her mother. It haunted us, and we suddenly missed a person we'd never got to meet. I wrote a poem about hating myself, and how that had become my personal brand to the extent that my peers no longer believed it. Next, Sherita wrote a poem about overflowing with love and curiosity for almost everything, and Carla wrote a poem that freshened my view of digital poetics. I wrote a poem about some poets I respect and getting my shoe shat on by a bird. Megan's poems were always the best. None of us could ever top her, which really ruffled my feathers until Kyla wrote a poem about surviving toxic institutions. Out of nowhere, Ocean wrote a poem about journeying towards self-love and loneliness as time spent with the world, and then a bird shat on my shoe. As usual, we agreed I'd really written a poem about wanting my ex-girlfriend back. I'd written a poem about losing our love years earlier, but it hadn't gone over so well. Consensus was, it was nothing like holding her warm body. That's that one. Yeah, those are the poems. Should I just get into the...
Yeah, you can go for it.
All right, into the excerpt. Whoops. So yeah, this is from my thesis project I'm working on right now. I guess I should give some context. The novel doesn't really have a title yet that I'm committed to saying on the radio. Okay, the characters in the book don't have proper character names. They're named the male and the female at this point. And so this part is from the perspective of the male. And part of his story is, like, getting over this breakup that he had about a year ago, which he is still really troubled by and still frustrated at himself for feeling so troubled because he's kind of self-aware about it and realizes that it's kind of a dumb, like conflict for him to still have and stuff. But anyway, so that's his context. He's just like having these bad feelings, and he's at a party right now, and he's just recently done MDMA for his first real time. So anyway, that's the context. At 1:45 a.m., the male and the publicist sat on the middle stair of a five-stair entranceway that fronted the warehouse of a locker and partitions manufacturer on an industrial street not far from the after-hours dance party, and the publicist wrapped his left arm around the male's shoulders and firmly rubbed and squeezed the male's left biceps, and in a soothing tone of voice told the male that, quote, coming up, unquote, on 3,4-methylenedioxymethamphetamine could sometimes be an overwhelming experience, and that all he was feeling seemed to him completely normal and okay. The male's elbows rested on his knees, and his forehead rested in his palms. Through the triangular field of vision defined by his forearms, the male looked at his feet and studied the tiny fraying stitches along the side of his right sneaker, the irregular faded splotches of dirt, and three dark dots on the stair where his tears had recently landed. His heart rate was 26 beats per minute above his resting average. The publicist asked whether the male was okay. The male asserted that he was, quote, fine, unquote, but that he was indeed overwhelmed. The emotions currently overwhelming him were not overtly negative or destructive, the male claimed. They were perhaps even covertly positive, yet still overwhelming and confusing. The publicist urged the male to elaborate. The male stated that, as the publicist knew very well, he had recently harbored debilitating emotions of anger and jealousy toward his ex-girlfriend, but that now, in the current moment, under the influence of the current substances, all of these emotions seemed, quote, very far away, unquote, or as if they had been, quote, retooled, unquote, into mainly the emotions of sadness, loss, mourning, and, quote, weirdly, unquote, gratitude. He stated that he could not currently keep himself from thinking of his ex-girlfriend and of their lost relationship, but that currently, thinking of her, quote, all, unquote, he could think of about was the enormous improbability of his ever having met her at all. He asked the publicist whether he knew what he meant, and then immediately asked whether he had in fact just uttered the word retooled aloud, which the publicist confirmed amid their mutual laughter. The male stated that the probability that he would have encountered his ex-girlfriend amid the massive population and chaos of the world currently seemed staggeringly low, let alone the probability that the two would meet at a time when they were mutually emotionally available to begin a committed relationship, and that the documented fact that they had, in fact, met and had loved and cared for one another for 1.5 years now brought him a level of gratitude and tenderness that felt almost unbearable. He claimed that he had spent the past several months internally cursing his ex-girlfriend's existence, yet now it seemed empirically miraculous to him, and claimed that he did not currently care that she loved a new person. He was mainly grateful to know that a person like her could exist in their, quote, fucked up world, unquote, and he expressed an overwhelming desire to send her a text message apologizing for his recent childishness, thanking her for their time together, and attempting to convey some version of these thoughts. After a pause, the publicist said that if the male knew, quote, deep down, unquote, that this gesture would repair and strengthen his and his ex-girlfriend's friendship in a, quote, real way, unquote, then he should by all means contact her, but that, in his view, the male had already done some apologizing recently, and it hadn't much ameliorated the situation. He said that if the male wanted to contact his ex-girlfriend out of a desire to win back her love or attention, no matter how small or innocent that desire currently seemed, then he should certainly not contact her, at which point the male began sobbing and shaking, and the publicist pulled the male closer and rubbed his back firmly. The publicist claimed that the male's ex-girlfriend already knew very well how much the male still loved and admired and desired her, that this was not the issue. He, the publicist, stated that he'd recently decided that the goal of life was to always be attempting to send love out into the world without expecting it back. The male nodded and sobbed and asked the publicist whether he'd ever felt as depressed as the male lately felt, and the publicist answered emphatically in the affirmative. The male asked whether the publicist had ever considered committing suicide, and again the publicist confirmed it, stating that for many years he'd viewed death as the ultimate/only relief. This had peaked in adolescence, and early adulthood, before he'd had the psychological means to admit and embody his homosexuality, but the feeling continued to haunt him occasionally, sometimes for weeks or months at a time. The Mail stated that he sensed his friend was lately amid an especially positive phase emotionally, and the publicist admitted that this was the case, smiled, and began looking around for something unspecified, until he spotted a broken fragment of a tree's limb in the garbage-strewn grass and scuttled over to knock his knuckles against it. The type of conversation they were currently having, the Mail recognized, was colloquially known as a, quote, heart-to-heart, unquote. His heart rate was 19 beats per minute above his resting average. Sitting down, the publicist said that, quote, all, unquote, he knew, was that in order to not reach the point of killing himself, he had to go on doing everything that made him feel positively, as frequently as possible, and in the meantime to prioritize loving and caring about people. One thing that had been significantly helpful for him lately, he stated, was dancing. He claimed that the Male's ex-girlfriend was indeed a special person, and that she and the Male had indeed had a, quote, beautiful, unquote, period together. He had witnessed much of it himself, after all, but that this period had now ended. He slightly shook the Male's shoulder and emphasized that this was in fact good, because now, quote, new, unquote, events were happening in the Male's life, whether or not he could see or believe in them. And, he instructed, whenever the Male noticed himself drawn toward something, quote, small, unquote, for example, one relationship to one person, one demarcated period of his past, he must make every effort to, quote, run, unquote, in the other direction, to think about how large and powerful and continuous and full of potential the world truly was. He made a sweeping motion with his arm and loudly claimed that, quote, the universe was expanding, unquote, which slightly alarmed the Male, since his psychological counselor had uttered the same bizarre-seeming words to him verbatim in their most recent conversation. The Male asked whether the publicist had heard these words from him, that is, from the Male, but the publicist said he was fairly sure he hadn't. In any event, the publicist claimed, death would certainly come for each of them. This was life's only guarantee. And whatever death was, he felt confident it would be largely the same when it arrived, regardless of what either of them did. Thus, death was fundamentally, quote, boring, unquote. So why move that direction? The publicist asked, seemingly rhetorically. They might as well first experience, quote, some other shit, unquote, before they had to experience death. There was a long pause. The publicist rubbed the Male's back and urged him to, quote, let it all go, unquote, and the Male inhaled deeply and exhaled and was surprised to subtly perceive a small amount of weight seeming to stream off his body like a sheet of falling water, and he nodded his head and suggested that they should soon return to the party and dance. His heart rate was 7 beats per minute above his resting average. He thanked the publicist and said that he loved him very much, and the young men embraced one another. That's the end of that one.
That was Ben Stevenson reading three pieces. Ben, first off, thank you for that. I really appreciate you coming on to read those.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to go forward with a couple of questions.
Sure.
I guess the first one would be, how would you describe your relationship with writing?
That's actually something I was thinking about a lot today, earlier today. Yeah, because it's complicated. Sometimes it seems really cloudy to me, and I think I know what that relationship is, but it actually is probably something way different. So I think for me, like, as much as I don't like this about myself, I think that my relationship with writing is mostly expressionism. Like, I think that I'm just... ultimately, I'm writing my feelings, and when I have strong feelings about things, that's when I feel motivated to write, and I guess I just, yeah, I try to communicate, like, my feelings on the world. I don't know. There's it's a pretty classic, like...
Right, there's a weird taboo on that, though. Right. Maybe yeah. Unjustified.
Yeah, I mean, especially, like, I don't know, someone, like, of my... I don't know if we should get into, like, identity politics or not, but especially just someone like me, like... whatever cis like white man feelings like aren't whatever they're not important, right. And I'm not here to say that they are important, but I'm just saying that I think that feelings are like our primary experience of the world, and that they are I don't know, they're valid, they're political, they have like a weight or something. But yeah, I mean, I do definitely think that sometimes people probably think I verge on like the sentimental.
Right, and I guess the other question would be, would it be more justifiable if the if your relationship with it was really tortured, if it was a really difficult
right.
thing, kind of getting it out.
Yeah. Well, I think that you do. I think you always run that risk of appearing like some like tortured artist figure, which is not what I want to be. But I often do write out of like pain and out of like shame, and those kind of emotions are really motivating for me. One thing about my relationship to writing that I think about a lot is that I'd like to get to a place where I could also write really well while motivated by like happiness and joy right. and peace and those kind of things. So we'll see.
What's your writing routine like?
Well, right now I have like a studio space that I'm renting, and I go there pretty much every day. I have a lot of homework to do now too because of school, but I try to not let a day go by where I like don't think about the novel or change like one little thing or add a sentence or like anything like that. But right now I'm having a bit of trouble like putting in solid blocks of time. But yeah, my writing routine is easier when I have a draft done because I love editing. Like rewriting is kind of what I like doing more. So for now, it's just kind of like struggling through trying to get the first draft of this thing down. But
right, and yeah. then going from there.
Yeah.
And when you sit down at the desk, is it? Mm-hmm. Is it, you know, do you have a routine? Do you go to poetry first? Are you reading poetry first? Or are you looking for inspiration first? Or do you kind of just plunge into it?
Right. Like most people, probably I spend some time procrastinating on the internet. And, like, that will probably inform, like, some stuff about, like, how I'm feeling. But, yeah, the poetry is actually way newer for me because, like, the MFA program here, you have to do a certain number of 3 different genres of writing. So I took poetry just kind of like I've been sort of interested in it, but not fiction's my main thing. So it's cool to read like these poems because they're so new and I don't really know what I'm doing as a poet. It's just kind of a hobby, but it's fun.
That second poem you read, it's already pretty meta, and I guess we're just going to go into it straight on. But has writing about writing itself always been something that interested you, or is this more recent?
No, it has definitely been something that's always interested me. It's not always been something that I've done, and it's not something that I really necessarily want to do, but it keeps happening. I think, like, when I was a kid or when I was younger, like, Adaptation, that movie, do you know that movie?
Yeah, absolutely.
Was, like, my favorite movie. And I think that, like, might have informed a lot of my attitude about that stuff. Like, I think writing about writing can be really bad, but if you can use it as a metaphor for something else that's more important, I think that it's valid. But, yeah, I wouldn't say I'm, like, interested in it, but it keeps coming up in my work for sure. So there's a part of me that's interested in it. I just don't like admitting to it.
I was wondering, you started in the MFA program last year.
Yeah.
And the whole thing about, you know, learning writing and going to school for writing, I think that poses a lot of problems. And what were your thoughts going into the program?
No, definitely. I mean, I'm kind of more of the opinion that writing, I don't know, like, because the thing about these MFA programs is that people are always saying, can you even teach writing? Is that even a thing you can teach? I think that you can to an extent. I think that the things that you learn aren't things that come directly from texts and from people. It's things that you discover in yourself when you're given like this amount of time to work on your craft. Like, so I was excited mainly just to have like time, to work on this new thing I wanted to do and people around, to be supportive of that. And that's really what a writing program is, I think, is a bunch of people who care about the same thing and they're like supporting each other. And no one's like don't use any adjectives or anything. Like, it's not really like that. But yeah, I feel like I am getting a lot out of the program though. I'm glad I'm here. Yeah.
Great. Thanks so much for coming down to CITR today, Ben. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Hey, it's Prophecy Sun. Meow. You're listening to CITR Radio 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Hey man, come out to the Rio Sunday, December 4th for the UBC Film Sock's annual Big Lebowski Beverage Garden. It's totally free,
except the, you know, beverages,
and wear a costume to maybe win a prize. Doors are at 6, and the movie will start at 6:30 due to Reno. It's a 19-plus event.
Please abide.
Hey, this is Textbook CITR 101.9 FM. Last segment today, tell me about your paper. It's with Asia Moore. I want to also apologize on that last segment. There was some sketchy audio midway through. Sorry about that, Ben. But yeah, here's the last segment of the show. I hope you like it. It's the writer's episode here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Coast Salish people.
After. Just edit out me saying mean stuff.
Okay,
please.
Okay, well.
That's the only thing.
Okay, there's no slander. No slander allowed.
And that's hard for a poet or a writer in general, because that's all you do.
Is slander people?
Yeah. Pretty much.
This is Asia Moore. She's in UBC's creative writing program, focusing on poetry. I met her in my first year. We'd both just started university, but Asia had come from taking a few years off of school. Already a bit jaded. For this week's installment of Tell Me About Your Paper, me and Asia took a walk around campus.
I feel like there's a quote that I've been thinking about a lot lately. I can't remember his name. He said that all good art is just properly sublimated rage.
Oh.
It's like, yep.
I was thinking also in terms of gossip.
Yeah, or Sarah Sutherland, all good art is revenge.
That's good too.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is kind of, that's petty.
It's petty. And my favorite art is petty.
Midway through her degree, Asia moved to Montreal, attended the creative writing program at Concordia there. Now she's been back at UBC for a while. Asia has a conflicted relationship with the workshop format that most creative writing programs follow.
Well, it can happen that you say something about someone's work that they don't like, they don't forget about it, and then that. But that's also coupled with, like, probably if you don't like their work, they don't like yours.
Right.
Your work
and
is so
just,
different,
that
and
is
that's
what it
how
is.
The criticism
right.
comes through. And also, like, I don't know, I think it can be, I've been in and out of different writing programs. And I think that influences the way that I act and that I might act a little differently than someone who's only been in one. I know that sounds really conceited, and I don't mean it to come across that way, but like at Concordia, the courses are all year.
Right.
So you have all year, like you have a few weeks where you're not workshopping, you're just getting to know each other, whereas at UBC it's like right away, you're workshopping like first week.
That's a.
I don't know. That
there's no bonds of trust or.
No, not at all. And like, I don't know. I feel like every single semester of university, no matter what university it is, I've been like the university equivalent of like sent to the office. Like, I have gotten in like really big fights, basically. So I'm also used to that.
I actually don't think it's like conceited to say you have that knowledge because you've been in multiple programs. I think that seems like a very legitimate claim. Like you do have a bigger scope.
Sort of, yeah, it's like, I mean it's two programs instead of one.
Right.
So it's not that much bigger.
I think that like the other funny thing about what you're talking about is this kind of like who are you imagining the audience is? And who you imagine the audience is, and when it's a workshop, you have these people, and you know they're the ones that are going to read it first and foremost.
I definitely have had the feeling this semester of, like many, many times, of, like, having to factor that into what I'm going to submit, but also being like, I wish it was reasonable for me to just say, like, you and you and you can't have my work. You can't read it. You're not allowed. Like, you don't deserve it. You can't read that. It's not for you.
That's what they do with juries. You just disqualify people from sitting on the jury.
You don't have to make it sound so judicial. It's not like that. Kind of is. I just, like, I've had lots of experiences this. I think especially, like, if you are someone who writes, like, whatever you define this as, like, if you write politically, and especially if you're presenting as, like, a marginalized body, so, like, a woman, or that's the one that I'm most familiar with. I mean, the only one I'm familiar with. But, like, there's a tendency for people, like, I wrote a poem this semester, and it had the image of the Grand Canyon in it, and I got feedback saying, like, oh, that's so vaginal. Oh, my God, the symbol of the vagina, like, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, what? Or, like, I had that at Concordia where the first few things I brought in, people would be like, not really sure what this is about. I think it might be about sexual assault or, like, vaginas or whatever. And, like, people tend to read your work in a certain way because they can't help but conflate the speaker with the author, especially in the workshop setting where, like, they know you, so, and they can see you. So there were a couple times where I was like, there were poems, like, there's a poem that I am working on about hair because it's for a prompt about hair, and I need help with it, and I wanted to bring it in because I need help, but it, like, had too many, like, scenes about breaking my hymen or, like, whatever, and I was like, I can't really bring this in.
Right.
Have these people who, like, already think I'm a freak possibly read this poem and then, like, I don't know. Just,
there's stuff that's off limits then.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
You wouldn't bring to the workshop.
Which is, like, why I think it's more valuable
anyways,
to just...
I'm gonna head.
Make, I don't know, try to make your friends with writing, like, outside of the academic setting.
Over the weekend, Asia had to write a reflection essay for a poetry workshop, an end-of-the-year assignment that serves as a way of wrapping things up and thinking about the criticism and feedback you gleaned during the semester. I've been talking with her about this workshop over the past few months.
Tell me about what you were writing this weekend, then.
Okay, well, this weekend and also, like, into the last few weeks, because, like, in the last few weeks, I've been feeling pretty uncomfortable in my workshop, and partially that's because most of what I'm writing right now is prose poetry, and no one else has brought in any prose poetry, and it can be kind of jarring if you don't read it very often, and it's really hyper-personal, so it's very, like, I, you, me, him, her, us, our, like, focal, and so I read this piece by my grandma in a book about ready-mades, and she had done this really interesting prose poem where, like, it was broken into paragraphs, and then nothing in the paragraph had pronouns except the last sentence, and I was like, wow, that last sentence really lands, because there's no other pronouns in the piece, and so I was, like, having really gnarly insomnia at the time, and routinely do, and so I was like, I'm gonna try and do that, like, I'm gonna try to not have pronouns, and then in trying to do that, I just wrote this, like, 4-page, like, heavy pronoun, like, really super personal, like, couldn't get away from it, and so I was like, okay, I guess this piece is about the use of pronouns and about, like, how narcissism is political, especially if you are not a white cis man. And so I had brought that in and gotten, like, similar feedback that I usually get, and just was feeling really conflicted about, like, the feminine I and how to work that, like, I statements tend to either land or be so monotonous. And so then we had read an essay by Alice Notley called On Disobedience, where she basically talks about, like, the importance of situating the self, especially the feminine self. And so a lot of that writing was about, like, knowing when to. So a lot of that paper, that reflective exercise, was about, like, teaching myself to know when the criticism of the feminine I is valid or when it isn't. Which is still really hard and, like, a constant negotiation. And I think, like, part of, and in doing that, I sort of realized through writing it that, like, I don't really want my writing to be palatable or comfortable. Like, if someone is uncomfortable with it, that is the desired effect. And, like, or they're either uncomfortable or I think it resonates with them.
And either one is good.
Yeah. And so, like, I have, like, a fantasy about, like, having a book, and then at the end of the book, it's just, like, it's a piece that I've already written, it's really short, it's just, like, basically it's, like, against explaining yourself. Like, if this doesn't resonate with you, then it's not for you. And it's you who hasn't learned to recognize certain kinds of labor. Which is, like, really rude. And not a great place to begin your career, so I don't know if it's ever gonna come out.
How mean are you when you're giving credit?
I actually got feedback from my professor basically being like, you have to be more mean, which is ridiculous.
Because you're really generous. Because,
not that I'm generous, I'm just like, it's hard to criticize someone's art.
Yeah.
Because it's like something they've just put their entire self into, and like, well, possibly. And also, I feel like I'm a really bad candidate for workshop because two things. One, I can't really bullshit my way through a piece I don't like. But you're not allowed to say, scrap it, start something else different. That's like not reasonable. So you have to.
You have to salvage.
Yeah, you have to come up with something to say, and that's really hard for me. Also, I can be really diplomatic, like, verbally, but I can't fucking control my face at all. Which means that, like, several times someone's been like, whatever, just look at my face, and they know
straight
what I think, and I'm just like, or even in the reverse, like, if I like something a lot, then I'm, like, freaking out, and it's distracting, so... It's hard. It's a really awkward setting. It's like really inorganic. And like also, this is kind of true of all courses, but like it really bothers me when people are late. When people are late with their assignments. Like, I just fucking hate that. And it makes me a petty bitch, and it's fine, but like, so when people like don't turn their assignments in, like my two friends in the writing program are both people who are like perpetually late and never turn things in on time, and I fucking hate it.
I think it's disrespectful.
It is disrespectful. Like, I'm putting time to give you advice.
I think there's grounds for that resentment. That obviously doesn't stretch that far if you can still be friends with these people.
No, and I would say that there's no one, like, I don't hate anyone. They're all really, like, interesting in their own way. And, like, it's a really... I mean, part of it, too, is, like, if you want to be a successful writer... I don't know who I was talking to. I think it was my therapist who I was talking to about this. But, like, essentially, you just have to mentally prepare for people to hate you and to hate your work. It's just going to happen. Like, people hate the best writers I can think of. So much.
So sometimes, like, just because they're the best writers.
Yeah, like, and they're really upset that they can't make that. All of my favorite writers are Scorpios.
Which means what? Also, Asia's been on a pretty big astrology kick recently, which makes things more complicated. That's good or bad? Or?
No, I love it. I love Scorpios. A lot of people don't. Just like super watery, super emotional, really, really dark. So like Ariana Raines, Hannah Black, and Alice Notley are all Scorpios. And, like, I don't know, I feel like if you read their work back to back, you can pick up on the same energy.
That makes sense.
Does it? You don't believe in astrology.
I don't believe it, but I think that the three of them, from what I read, limited from what I read of them, are, yeah, they have maybe some of the same emotional resonances.
Yeah, I would say so. About writing papers, and I came up with a couple tips.
Did you really?
Yeah.
These are Asia's tips for writing papers.
Okay, here's mainly the big one. Don't double space it till the end.
Yeah.
You're just gonna feel like you did so much more work at the end. It's such a good feeling.
Yeah. It just expands.
Yeah, you're like, oh my god, I thought I'd written 5 pages, but really I've written 10. I'm a fucking wizard. This paper's basically done.
I also have trouble, like, actually working with double space.
It's really awkward to look at.
Yeah, it's uncomfortable.
It feels like being in elementary school.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good...
It doesn't feel very adult.
It doesn't feel very adult. But then when it does expand, when you get that, like, 7 pages to 15 pages expansion, you're like, oh, this is very adult, actually.
Yeah, you're like, oh, this is what it's all about. Oh, wow. What are you at?
Tip number two.
That's minimal. The other tip was just, if you're getting stuck, just read your horoscope. Take a break. Fucking be easy on yourself. And don't leave it till the last minute. It's the most fucking basic advice I can think of. Like, just don't do that. So stupid.
What if your horoscope tells you you
no,
leave things to last
your
minute?
Horoscope would never tell you to leave things to your last minute. It would just say that you have an inclination to. So reading the horoscope would just, like, alert you to that.
And then you would fight it.
You would fight it. So, like, yeah.
The horoscope is a call to arms.
Yeah.
Have you ever gotten paper ideas from what's been said in your horoscope?
No, but I have. Oh my god. Okay, I've explicitly written horoscope or astrological poetry, obviously. B, written poems that afterwards had a totally weird astrological element. Brought one of them in. So this was in the piece that was really narcissistic, which was called, like, For the Inclusion of, and then every section is like a pronoun. And it was like really astrological by the end. And someone in my work.
Hey, I'm sorry, I had to cut this one short. You can check out the rest of this on the CITR SoundCloud page. My name is Josh. This is Textbook CITR 101.9 FM. Next up is Discorder Radio. Hope you enjoy that. Thank you so much for listening today.
You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are now tuned into the sounds of Discorder.
1, 2, 3, Android. Are you ready? Come on. Are you ready?
Hey, this is Wade.
And I'm Matt.
And this is Discorder Radio.
We're the on-air baby of Discorder Magazine, your Vancouver Indie Music Monthly.
You're listening to Discorder Radio, CITR.
CITR.
CITR 101.9 FM.
Tune in every Tuesday for live interviews, music from the hottest local artists, and good times. It's 5 o'clock Tuesday. It's time for Discorder Radio. Big announcement out of Ottawa today. Two pipelines have been approved, including the highly contested Kinder Morgan pipeline. Much the chagrin of many here in BC, including DOA. Here's Pipeline Fever to kick it off today on Discorder Radio.
Pipeline Fever! It's running rampant! Pipeline Fever!